You're listening to this podcast, so I know you care about the war in Israel right now. And you've been reading the headlines. Massacre in Gaza. Genocide perpetrated by Hamas. No, by Israel. But if you've been listening to this podcast long enough, you know one thing. This stuff seems complicated. And honestly, no one can really just pick a side or decide an opinion without really learning, without really knowing what you're talking about. And that's where this podcast comes in. Check out Unpacking Israeli History, now in its sixth season. They have episodes with topics ranging from what is Hamas anyway, to whether Israel should ransom captured soldiers, and the history of Israel and its disengagement from Gaza in 2005. Unpacking Israeli History cuts through the noise and helps you understand Israel's present through understanding Israel's history. So, educate yourself. Learn the history behind the headlines. Find Unpacking Israeli History wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Amanda Borshaldan. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Today is Thursday, January 7th. I'm Amanda Borshaldan. I'm joined by our founding editor, David Horowitz, and our senior analyst, Chaviv Retegur. Those of us in Israel woke up to the news of the storming of the Capitol in Washington, D.C. As a U.S. citizen living abroad for these past two decades, I have to admit I was actually physically ill watching the footage of it. When I moved to the United States from Canada as a 10-year-old, the first lesson I learned was that January 20th was the peaceful passing of power from president to president. I experienced for the first time that morning also the Pledge of Allegiance, with pupils standing up with their hand against their heart and pledging allegiance to a flag. It felt very much to me that America's democracy, which is roughly the religion of the country, was being overrun, that the temple of America, the Capitol, was taken by the pagans. It was extremely disturbing, to say the least. David?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many people in this country stayed up, you know, all night, but I was one of them. And, you know, when you're a long way away and that, you know, that there's not that absolute immediacy, but it felt was just awful to watch the scenes unfolding, awful to internalize that the defeated president had incited an assault on as you say, and as the president-elect said, you know, the citadel of liberty. And continued to stoke the motivation even as it was playing out. I mean, it's just extraordinary, horrific things that you never thought you would see. You know, this has been a very controversial president. We can talk a little bit about the nuances and the complications of Israel's relationship with him. And I know that people had warned that it might end this way. Was very, very hard to believe that was actually going to happen. And yet we saw it playing out.
Chaviv, you're also a U.S. citizen. How did this affect you when you learned of it?
I mean, I'm still, you know, it's not just, I feel everything that you described and everything that David described. I was up until 3 a.m. I gave up a little earlier than David. It's confusing. It's confusing to me because, you know, they're not going to win the vote, and they didn't win the vote today, right? The Senate went on at 8 p.m., it met again, and it certified the Electoral College vote. What are they trying to accomplish? What was the idea? Why? And so many of them, you know, there was a neo-Nazis and Holocaust deniers who stormed into Nancy Pelosi's office, sat in her chair at her desk, and took selfies of themselves with their masks off. They didn't have masks, obviously, but I mean, just informed the world that they were doing this. It was about showing themselves to be doing this. It was something I think that is fascinating that I'm trying to get a grip on, because I realize I really don't understand what's happening. I've also been out of America 20 years, and it's changed. Something has changed there. I went to high school in Wisconsin. There are people at my lunchroom cafeteria who had hunted their lunch They came with venison from their hunts in the forests in northern Wisconsin. I know Trump's America. I mean, I've socialized with Trump's America. I don't know these people. I have no idea what happened yesterday.
This isn't America. This is America. This is very much the America, the ugly America. It's come to America. You could see in the people who are crashing through the Capitol, they were wearing their hunting gear. They were wearing their riot gear. I had a hard time picking out who was the police and who was the, you know, the person breaking in. It was just a fascinating look at a side of America that most people living abroad definitely don't see. And most people living on the coast just have no idea exists.
Yeah, but if you keep, you know, I'm sure there are elements of this that are not clear. But broadly speaking, if somebody who is charismatic and powerful and has extraordinary means of communication, and in this day and age, the President of the United States certainly has those capabilities, continues to tell hundreds of millions of people in a country that black is white, eventually, and maybe not eventually, people are susceptible and they are impressionable, and people start to internalize and to believe, and sections of those people do outrageous things. I mean, it's not the first time in history that you've seen this, and we're in an era now where the potential to mislead and misrepresent is greater than it's ever been before. It's an inevitable consequence of lying to lots of people and inflaming them over and over again.
He's hardly the first politician to contest an election. Even 2 years ago, when Stacey Abrams in Georgia contested the gubernatorial vote, she did not concede for 10 days. She said it was maybe not her personally, but her supporters said the vote was stolen. These are the Democrats talking. The idea that it's gone so far beyond the pale in this particular juncture is extremely, extremely extraordinary.
But I don't know if it's comparable to the protestations of fixes and theft of the past. This was the president. This was a president who kept telling people, you know, it's not over. We've won, and we're going to ensure that victory is recognized. And who, you know, earlier in the day yesterday said, you know, you don't take back our country with weakness. You've got to show strength. So I'm not sure that there are comparable, relentless and such inflammatory resistance to what happened from somebody in that position. So one last thing, which is, you know, there's a lot of people, but there weren't hundreds of thousands of people. You know, one other thing that you look at from Israel is, how is it remotely possible that the security arrangements were so utterly inadequate? And that's really putting it mildly. You know, you knew that there were going to be protests, and if you don't stop protesters, you know, on they will go. Why on earth was there not a competent security deployment?
I honestly think the Capitol Police couldn't imagine this outcome. But one of the things that struck me was, I remember when Islamic State was running rampaging through Iraq and Syria, that they had this habit of beheading people on television. And everyone was, you know, there was the standard moral horror, and everyone was very upset. But one of the more interesting things were the psychologists and the intelligence analysts who said, okay, but why actually are they beheading? I mean, this is also making them unpopular in the Arab world. Arabs also don't appreciate beheadings just as much as Europeans and Americans. What is this actually about? And the conclusion that they drew, I thought was fascinating, was that this is actually a recruitment drive, these beheadings. This is the message to young Muslims, mostly men in the West, in the rest of the world, and saying to them, you want to get out of the small life that, you know, Western democracy gives you? You want to have a bigger life, a life of violence, but also a life of religious puritanism that launders that violence and tells you it's okay? You want to have a life of power? Come to us. You can behead people. That is a message that the sort of chattering classes of the world, myself included and us included, I think, don't imagine could possibly be contained in a beheading, but actually was the point of the beheading. And I'm wondering if it wasn't that, if it wasn't MAGA, you know, Make America Great Again, the movement, the brand that Trump built up around himself that really took over the Republican Party over the last 4 years, isn't on a recruiting drive. In other words, Trump knows he can't change the vote. There are too many states. There are too many millions of votes in one direction that would have to be canceled. I mean, in the vote yesterday, last night in the Senate, two-thirds of the Republican caucus voted against, voted to throw out hundreds of thousands of Pennsylvania votes. Two-thirds of the Republican caucus voted against letting Pennsylvanian voters, on evidence that they cannot actually bring to a court and show us in public what the actual evidence is. They have a lot of evidence around the edges, a lot of circumstantial evidence, but they have no actual proof. And why did they do that? With the whole claim that he didn't lose the election is a claim that has allowed him to not walk away from the Republican Party and prevented the Republican Party from walking away from him after losing an election, which is what parties do when an election is lost, right? But the base is now fired up by having the election stolen. What is this raid on? It was so
cinematic.
I compared it on Twitter, and maybe it wasn't smart because Twitter sometimes misunderstands you. I compared it to sexual assault. It was an intentional. They couldn't win by persuasion, so they took it by force. It was about power. It was about showing that you don't have to be restricted by the rules that everyone else in society imposes on you. And it was about standing gloating in Nancy Pelosi's office, because what are they going to do about it?
And live blogging the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Like a recruitment drive. Trump is trying to hold on to the Republican Party. And then I saw his statement this morning. Statement by President Trump on the electoral certification. Two sentences. Even though I totally disagree with the outcome of the election and the facts bear me out, nevertheless, there will be an orderly transition on January 20. Right? He risks losing the Republicans because Kelly Loeffler, the senator who's a deep, deep Trumpist, said, I can't vote against certification now because of what happened yesterday. And then he says, I have always said we would continue our fight to ensure that only legal votes are counted. While this represents the end of the greatest first term in presidential history, it's only the beginning of our fight to make America great again. Even in the tweet, in the statement that he issues where he says, okay, guys, whoa, 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 let's back off. We're starting to lose the Trumpist Republicans in the Senate. He says, this is just the beginning. It's a recruitment drive. He's going to hold on to the Republican Party and take it down with him.
The three of us are watching what is unraveling in America from Israel. And the question can only be, could this also take place here in the Holy Land? David?
Look, you know, you wanted to say until yesterday that this obviously couldn't possibly happen in America. So I don't think anyone can make definitive statements about what can and can't happen. We had the Prime Minister assassinated within our living memory. Apparently anything can happen. I think what is playing out now has all kinds of implications for Israel, along with that one. We have a prime minister who has railed against the institutions, the pillars of our democracy. I refuse to believe that he would go as far down the path as Trump has gone, in terms of protesting and galvanizing protests and opposition. But I think everything that's playing out affects us. You sit here and you know that the dismay and the grief that we feel here is the opposite of what Israel and America's enemies are feeling at the moment. You know, the delight in Tehran. You're already starting to hear the mockery from other countries and so on. And then, of course, there's the really complicated issue of Israel having had a very, very strong relationship with Trump, the Israeli leadership very close to him, and the Israeli public overwhelmingly supportive of lots of policies that he took that were helpful for Israel. It's a pretty complicated situation now for an Israel that requires, depends on, and deserves bipartisan support in an America that is so riven and now brutally riven.
I think America is already pulled out of the world in a big way. It doesn't have, fleets around the world. It doesn't set the global order. It doesn't challenge Iran in meaningful ways under Obama and probably under Biden, even if Trump was an exception. The world is already sort of realigning on to deal with an America that doesn't seem able to handle its role as the largest power, the largest economy, Iran is happy, is actually happy today. It's not just that Iran is now teasing America and trolling America. Iran knows that Iraqis and Syrians and Lebanese are watching, and everyone in Lebanon hoping America pushes back against Hezbollah and Iran's power in Lebanon now knows America probably is not, literally doesn't have the competence internally, the domestic stability to for a Biden administration to have a serious, powerful, strong foreign policy. Maybe we're overstating, you know, Biden also won the Senate last night. So barely. Foreign policy is barely, but
it's 50-50 policy, and his vice president is the tiebreaker. This is not a, I mean, it's not a decisive win. This is very sad.
Right. Which means it'll be hard to bang out a federal budget, but on foreign policy, he'll probably have majorities and maybe we're at the beginning of a great period for America of influence and power and help and helping the democracies around the world and solving problems, you know, but it doesn't feel that way right now. That was everything David said. That was astounding watching that.
You know, I just,
I'm still not over it.
Let's, you know, allow ourselves to not be so bleak for a moment and think of Israel after Rabin when our democracy was tottering for sure. And it's not, you know, anything we can be remotely complacent about ever since. But we did kind of pull back. I think people saw into the abyss and realized that we were doomed, basically, if we couldn't bridge some, at least some of our most foundational differences. I just now having allowed, you know, a crack of optimism, I want to close it again. I think where Israel's concerned, people know that if we don't get it together, we are so vulnerable. We are a tiny little country in a really nasty area, and therefore we better conquer our internal differences. I just hope that America finds the internal strength to start to heal as opposed to plunging ever deeper.
Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks for joining me, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. A special thanks to our producer, Raul Woodliff. I'm Amanda Borshaldan.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And on our mothership, thetimesofisrael.com.